Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Today's episode may be of especial interest to our one and only super producer, Mr. Max Williams, who is by far, out of the three of us, the biggest sports fan. I'm Ben. Noel, would you agree that Max is probably leading the charge when it comes to sports?
Well, yeah, Max is what you might call a real sport head. You're looking quite sporty today, too, Ben. There, you got what you might call a bit of a sport head going on with that dapper ball cap situation.
Oh, thank you. Yes. This is just one of those hats I ended up with. It's kind of like that time, Noel, you remember when I just all of a sudden had an ancient Steelers hat and I just decided to wear that on our road rally documentary. That was cool, but we learned firsthand. People in Pennsylvania have feelings about the Steelers.
Yeah, they have Steeler feelings. Hashtag Steeler feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, today's episode surrounds a part of the country that, if I'm not mistaken, you've spent a little bit of time in.
Today does take us to Central America. And as you know, I lived for a time in Guatemala. This episode takes us to the countries of Honduras and El Salvador. Now, these countries themselves are not the biggest countries in the world. El Salvador is about the size of Wales, for instance. In 1969, it had a population of just around 3 million people. And especially in the 60s, social inequality was pretty severe. And so a small group of people controlled, you know, most of the land, most of the companies and so on. We're doing myth busting today. I guess we should give the log line first. Here's the idea. Here's the claim. In 1969, El Salvador and Honduras, these relatively small but beautiful countries, got in a war for 4 days, something called the Football War.
Yeah, maybe not a full-fledged out-and-out war, definitely a conflict, to be sure. But the question is, did this micro-war get started as a result of sport differences?
Yeah, and that's what we have to establish, because if you are not familiar with this part of the world, that can sound, dare I say it, ridiculous to say that people might get in conflicts over football or what we in the U.S. call soccer.
I mean, here, the worst you're going to get is maybe people setting some cars on fire, sure, you know, looting some Targets or whatever to get their frustrations out for their team not prevailing in a big game. You're going to hear me using terms like team and big game because I want to sound like I'm part of the club, even though I'm definitely not. I think that'll become apparent. Ben, I know you're not exactly the biggest sport head in the world, but you are an expert in international affairs. So I think between myself, you, and Max, we kind of make one whole person here.
Yeah, we've got the Max nod of approval, because Max, you already know where we're going with part of this. Soccer fans especially can have a reputation. Football matters to people in a very big, deep, abiding way across the world, right? It's serious stuff. And just like you said, Noel, this can lead to some acts of violence. So here's what happens. We said that El Salvador at this time in 1969, kind of small, population of 3 million. Most of the country is controlled by this small group of elites.
Would you call those landed gentry, perhaps?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, just so. And Honduras also just has a small number of people controlling it socially, but Honduras is 5 times the size of El Salvador, but it only has a population of 2.3 million. So it's more land, fewer people. And this means that if you live in El Salvador, right, and you want to have more farmland, you're going to move to Honduras. There's just more space there. So these people from El Salvador are moving to Honduras in droves, specifically to work for U.S. fruit companies, which are kind of supervillains in Latin America.
Absolutely. We know other stories that have revolved around, say, what is it, the Chiquita Banana Company? They essentially were responsible for a coup in Guatemala?
Yes, in 1954. And also, fruit companies also got up to some dirt in Hawaii. We have a pretty great Stuff They Don't Want You to Know episode about the overthrow of the Kingdom of Hawaii. We can say it's great because we are actually not on that episode. Our friend of the show, Dana Schwartz, and super producer Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson, actually did that. They gave us a break.
Definitely put that one in your back pocket for after you finish listening to this episode. Here's the thing. This conflict between, you mentioned the land mass disparity, I guess, between the two, and the fact that a lot of folks were moving from El Salvador to Honduras. Honduran President Oswaldo López Arellano didn't really care for this, this interloping, let's call it. And he started to actually deport thousands of Salvadorans back to their home country. Why was that, Ben?
Well, it's because there was a political tension going on. The ruling class of El Salvador had been pretty much on board with people leaving the country because with fewer people in the country, there were also fewer demands for more equality, right? But if you're in Honduras, imagine you were a person living in Honduras and you are not one of the ruling elites. You are fighting for your own land rights. You are fighting for more access to opportunity. And all of a sudden you're flooded with immigrants. This just makes your resentment grow. So the Honduran government at the time, under President Arellano, as you said, the government at the time says, okay, we're going to try to make things cool with the lower classes. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to pass this law about land reform. But the land reform law does not apply to those elites. It does not apply to the U.S. fruit companies. It focuses on the land settled by those folks from El Salvador.
Because essentially these Salvadorans are coming in and staking their claim on Honduran land. And this is no longer sitting well with the government and the citizens of Honduras. They're basically saying, hey, get off my lawn. This is for us, not for you.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty on base, I would say. We know that by late 1969, the number of Salvadorans living in Honduras had actually ballooned up to 350,000. You can read an excellent BBC article about this that relates the broad strokes of the story. It's by Toby Luckhurst. It's called Honduras versus El Salvador, the football match that kicked off a war. A little bit of spoiler in the title there, but not for long. We'll get to this point. So, Noel, like you said, tensions, you know, and the Honduran government is sort of selling the people a false bill of goods because they're focusing on these migrants, but they're not focusing on the problems in Honduras that were existing far before mass immigration. Instead, we see formation of political committees, organizations, things that would protect the interest of the ruling elite. In Honduras, the folks who own most of the land formed something called the National Federation of Farmers and Livestock Farmers of Honduras. Sounds nice. Sounds sexy. Like a union. Yeah.
Sexy name.
The whole goal is to just keep those people wealthy, by the way.
Yeah, that's sort of the status quo. Keep the rich rich and let them get richer. And don't worry so much about the lower class. And if you do, it tends to be a bit of a ticking a box kind of, hollow gesture. There are other things that were leading to this simmering tension because there were some territories or some areas that were in dispute there in the Gulf of Fonseca, which is a little body of water on the Pacific coast. This is actually shared, a number of islands, rather, in this Gulf are shared between the two countries and Nicaragua, which is never the best situation because, you know, ownership becomes part of the equation pretty quickly, especially when people start, you know, settling and building lives for themselves and ways of generating income. So essentially, this war was these simmering tensions that would ultimately erupt were as a result of these land disputes and the, you know, finite availability of land.
Yeah. Yeah. And when the Honduran president makes this decision to kick out these folks from El Salvador, he does so by taking the land that they have staked their claim to. And also, he turned the population, the average Honduran, against these El Salvadorian immigrants.
Yeah, they were like harassing them. There were pretty regular beatings and abuses, you know, physical altercations. These folks were not being treated very well. And then to boot, they were deported back to El Salvador, where the president, Fidel Sanchez Hernandez, and his government had a really hard time dealing with this influx of folks coming back to his country after they had kind of, you know, adapted to there being less folks there.
Exactly. So now you have, if you're a person in this situation, now you have literally no place to go, right? The place you lived has been taken by one government or the other, right? Honduras is saying Honduras for Hondurans, and the government of El Salvador is saying, ah, sorry, this is not a keep your seat warm situation. So to be very clear, there's a technical term for this. It sucks. And yeah. This, you can read this, you can read some more details about this in a book called The 100-Hour War by Dan Hagedorn, which covers the blow-by-blow of what happens here. So in the midst of all this stuff happening and these people moving back and forth across the border trying to find a better life for themselves, there is a football match. There's a soccer game. And we've talked in the past about, I can't remember which show this was on, but we've talked in the past about how I personally believe that sports are often a substitute for war in some ways.
And religion, or maybe not a substitute for religion, but they can take on the same kind of evangelism in some ways that religion has, where folks are so behind their team and they're the only team, you know, in the world as far as they're concerned. And every other team is against them in the same way that folks, you know, kind of treat their particular God or their particular faith.
100%. Yeah. And that's because people have such strong identification with their, you know, their favorite sports teams. And in this part of the world, that kind of association is sort of times 10 what you would encounter here in the U.S. Oh, and for the record, folks, Atlanta does have a pretty great soccer team of its own. I don't know if you guys have gone to the games, but even if you don't care for soccer or football, it's great to go. It's great energy. It's cool to hang out.
Seems like a good time. I've not been yet, but I really want to. They also do this really cool thing with the local art community where every game they have like a man of the game or something like that, and a electric guitar that's painted by a local artist they choose for each one is presented to man of the match. That's what it's called. Is presented to whoever the like MVP of that particular game was.
Awesome.
Okay. And our buddy Nick Benson, excellent artist and good friend of the show, has done one of those for him.
Oh, that's right. He has. Yeah, shout out to Nick. He is a good friend of ours. He also does all the art for Run the Jewels, which is weird to know someone. Well, we have weird jobs, so I guess his job's not that weird.
And all the art for a really cool upcoming secret project of another thing that we're involved in.
Yes, more to be revealed on that one. It's been so hard not to talk about it. But all will be revealed. In the meantime, as you can tell, fraught political tensions between Honduras and El Salvador mean that people are looking for an outlet
Yeah, and these fraught political tensions are exacerbated by the media, yes. Which I'm not, I don't know, Ben, you might be able to speak a little bit more about the relationship between the media and the government in Central America, but it strikes me, you know, in the research for this, that maybe the government has a little bit more control over the media in these countries than maybe we see here. What do you think?
At this time, yeah, the media is heavily controlled by the government, unless it's oppositional media. I would say even more importantly, it's controlled by the people who own the outlets, right? They own the means of information dissemination. And they're, those folks, by the way, are the same folks who own like 80 to 90% of the land. So they have the tools to make this propaganda campaign to whip up the masses against each other instead of asking why so few people control so much. That's the question that often gets dodged, right? Before we sound too revolutionary about it. Anyway, everybody is pumped. They're so stoked about this soccer game, this football game. And these countries have similar cultures, by the way. They speak the same language. Most people have the same or similar religious beliefs. And when they meet on the football field pitch, excuse me, sorry, Max.
Everything I know about soccer, I learned from the wonderful television series, Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso.
I know that it's all about qualifying. That's the term they use, qualifying. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the 1970 FIFA World Cup, which is a big deal, apparently, is coming up that June. And the teams of Honduras and El Salvador are in competition to qualify for the 1970 FIFA World mm-hmm. Cup. And this is a three-game series. The first game, Honduras beats El Salvador in a 1-0 victory. And then on June 15th, in a game played in San Salvador, El Salvador wins 3-0, as they would say in UK football.
What a ludicrous display, they would say in IT crowd, which is a great episode.
It's a good way to just, if you're in the UK, just say what a ludicrous display. And then you're like, you can just kind of fake your way through the rest of the conversation at the
right. So I do want to go back to setting the scene, though. So really, for a lot of people, if you just saw these teams meet, the people on those teams would seem very similar. The only difference would appear to be their dress, right? Their uniforms. They're wearing the colors of their national flag. So El Salvador is wearing blue with white trim. Honduras wears white trimmed with royal blue. So they're kind of inverses of each other, which I think is
interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And both of these games that you mentioned, though, with the 1-0 to Honduras and the 3-0 to El Salvador, both of these were games that occurred like amid near riots. Things that were pretty much riots were happening. There were a lot of very vociferous, vehement displays of national pride. Like picture people, you know, screaming the anthem, waving the flag, and then like throwing bottles and saying, you know, well, I dare someone from Honduras or El Salvador, depending, to come around here. This, you know, this Honduras for Hondurans kind of vibe. And we all know the problem with the term in the UK is soccer hooligans,
yes,
right? They have a bit of a reputation. That kind of behavior is occurring here as well. And what you see is that thousands of soccer supporters, several thousand from El Salvador, had traveled 700 miles northwest for the final match. This is very much a Ted Lasso moment, right? This was so the two teams are tied and they have this tiebreaker game, this third game. That's where everyone is going. It's held in Mexico and the stadium is huge. You can fit like 100,000 people in there. And these folks from El Salvador, mostly from El Salvador, fill in the bottom sort of 15,000 seats of the stadium. And then back home, people in El Salvador are tuned into the radio on the edge of their seats. The world is watching and listening to see what happens, to see which country wins the game. Because in a way, psychologically, that feels like they're winning the conflict over this immigration problem.
That's right. And this was evident even back in El Salvador, where Salvadorans were hanging out and having parties, dancing even next to their radios and celebrating with this early win. SI.com has a fabulous article that kind of looks at this more through the sports angle, written by Michael McKnight. You can check that out. Soccer, War, Nothing More. Really great title there. So do check that one out too for a little more of the sports angle. And at the same time, the armies of both of these nations, which are not that far apart from one another, after all.
They're right next to each other.
Right next to each other, are lining the borders, carrying weapons, and wearing identical uniforms. Why is that? Why do they have the same uniforms, Ben?
Because again, it's very similar. That's one of the strange parts of this story. These are two different nations, to be clear, but culturally, in many, many ways, these populations are similar. And I was thinking of a way for us to kind of contextualize what happens next. So we're in June 27th, right?
They're neck and neck. They're neck and neck in terms of qualifying. There is a third and final qualifying match that is to take place in Mexico City.
Yes. And on the day of the match, El Salvador, the government of El Salvador, severs all diplomatic ties with Honduras.
Yikes.
This is here's my comparison. So this is like for baseball fans. I'm going to lean on you a bit for this, Max. Baseball fans, you're familiar with like the World Series, right? And there are what's the most popular Canadian baseball team in your mind, Max?
I think it's probably a hockey team.
Well, the Toronto Blue Jays are the last standing one after the Montreal Expos.
Okay,
didn't exist anymore. So Toronto Blue Jays.
Okay, so imagine there is a game between like let's just say the Yankees and the Blue Jays. And on the eve of that game, Canada severs all diplomatic ties with the U.S. That sounds a little weird, right? But that's what happened.
A little weird, easy to interpret as a political flex, football adjacent.
Yes, yeah. And the government said, we're not really doing this because of the football game. We're doing this because Honduras has not taken any action to punish all those people who are committing crimes against Salvadoran immigrants.
All those beatings, all of those abuses that we talked about, they are claiming that this act was as a direct result of the government of Honduras not doing anything about those actions.
Mm-hmm. And apparently this treatment accelerated as the games went on. And the problem got so bad that the interior minister said around 12,000 Salvadorans had left Honduras after that second soccer match because of the wild persecution that's occurring. The day after the game, you'll see a U.S. news agency called UPI. They publish a story with the headline, Soccer War, won by El Salvador, 3-2.
That's right. It's a legacy media outlet, United Press International. Don't really hear that one thrown around quite as much anymore, but they are still around. But you got to imagine, Ben, I mean, if the Hondurans were messing with the Salvadorans before this football adjacent tension erupted, I can imagine that it really would have been exacerbated by this.
Yeah. And there's a question here about how much of a role the media had to play in this. According to that UPI report, at the third game, there were almost 2,000 Mexican police who were there to stop the violence as Salvadorans are chanting murderers, murderers from the stands. And so the world media started to think this was a war that was due to soccer.
Yeah.
But a lot of experts looking back say, this war would have happened, or this conflict would have happened regardless of the game. It just maybe sped things along.
Well, it didn't help much that UPI coined the soccer war in their headlines. They literally referred to it as soccer war won by El Salvador 3-2. So that was the outcome of that game there in Mexico City. People lost their minds. These border skirmishes got worse and worse, like you said, in the days following that upset. And as a result, the border between El Salvador and Honduras was closed, with these skirmishes taking place more and more frequently.
Yeah. They had also seen this in the cards early on. They felt a growing tension in the wind. As a result, both governments had been actively increasing their military might for a while. At the time, there was a U.S. arms embargo, so they couldn't buy all the toys they wanted, but they did find other ways of getting hardware. And a lot of it, like, they were purchasing old World War II stuff.
Right, like vintage fighter planes, like F-4U Corsairs, P-51 Mustangs, and all of that. Where do they get these marvelous toys, or whatever it was that the Joker said in Batman? From private individuals who had these in their collection, which I guess is a thing. By the way, great reporting on this from ThoughtCo.com. Kennedy Hickman wrote a really great piece for them called Latin America, the Football War. Also highly recommend giving that one a full read. So like we said, things are escalating. And early in the morning on July 14th, the Air Force of El Salvador started doing strikes against Honduras, hitting these targets. And this is when things kind of get past the point of no return. Border skirmishes, okay, maybe things can settle down a little bit. But once you start actively, you know, doing air attacks, airstrikes on a neighboring country, it's a little tough to roll that back.
Yeah, exactly. The troops are also on the move. They're going after some islands that are owned by Honduras, and they get into conflicts with the army of Honduras, but the army of Honduras is smaller, and the Salvadoran troops, as a result, are able to advance pretty steadily. On the flip side, the Salvadoran Air Force got absolutely waxed by the Honduran Air Force. So think of it like El Salvador is starting to control the land, and Honduras is starting to control the sky. This is where we introduce a Polish journalist. I'd like to apologize for pronunciation, just in case.
It's a doozy.
Ryszard Kapuściński. I think that's close.
Yeah, excellent job.
Yeah, thank you, man. So this is one of the reasons he's important. This journalist is one of the few foreign correspondents who is on the ground when this conflict begins.
That's right. And according to some of the initial reports that he filed, he described the conflict in the Honduran capital, which, by the way, is one of my favorite named capitals in the whole world, Tegucigalpa. It is fun to say. He reported the conflict there using the country's only teleprinter machine. And this is after President Lopez Arellano communicated with his ambassador in the United States about the invasion.
Yeah, and he would go on to write a book called The Soccer War, which is kind of a recollection of his life and times during that conflict. And in this book, if you read it, you'll see weird, interesting references. You get a real snapshot of the tension and the effectiveness of the propaganda that was being spread. He would see graffiti that says, "Nobody beats Honduras, and we shall avenge 3-0. It's interesting to wonder what Ted Lasso would have made of this.
Oh, he would have said some pithy, you know, aphorism of some kind. Everyone would have shaken hands and gone home, you know?
You know, back in the States, we like to say, takes a little shaking to make a milkshake.
It's true. It's true. And believe. So it's understandable why this football war, soccer war narrative was so easily fed. I mean, you mentioned, you know, the graffiti, you know, the whole "we shall avenge" narrative, specifically referencing the soccer game. So it's definitely, it's kind of a chicken or egg question. I mean, I kind of think that the egg lies with the media, but also, I mean, these tensions were real, separate from the soccer match. And then the soccer match just kind of added fuel to those already simmering fires of resentment. So Honduran aircraft hit back and hit El Salvador oil facilities and other depots, which caused some real problems in the supply chain and in getting, you know, much needed fuel to the front lines. So their network of infrastructure was really, really badly affected. And the Salvadorian offensive started to kind of slow. And eventually they couldn't go on.
Right. Yeah, they got bogged down. And during this time, on July 15th, the OAS, Organization of American States, they get everybody together. They convene an emergency session and they agree El Salvador needs to withdraw from Honduras. The government of El Salvador, they're in the capital, San Salvador, say, we're not going to do this. We're not getting out. We're not stopping the beef. We're not squashing the beef or squashing the soccer ball here unless you can promise that there will be reparations paid to all the Salvadorans who were displaced. And additionally, any of our folks who are living in Honduras, they can't be harmed. And it's true. I mean, the actions taken against Salvadorans at this time, well, it was pretty gruesome. So the OAS says, okay, let's work through this. And they are able to, just 3 days later, officially arrange a ceasefire on July 18th. And on July 20th, the ceasefire actually goes into place.
Yeah. I was just thinking about this, trying to harp back to an episode we just did. But if you think about this, you know, this 1970, 1969, this is a straight like land grab. That's exactly what, you know, I mean, there's a lot of other things, but it's basically about land. This is against the Kellogg-Brand Pact, isn't it?
I think it is. I think you're absolutely
so there,
right.
There is basis for, you know, outside organizations of being like, hey, you guys can't cause this war, because you could argue this war is about, you know, the resentments and all that, but that all springs from the fact that El Salvador doesn't have enough land for their people. I mean, the reason why is debatable, but
It also shows how pacts like that are ultimately kind of toothless and difficult to enforce, because it's hard to pinpoint, or it's very easy to dance around what the actual root cause of the war is. You know what I mean? Like you can just kind of say, oh, no, it's about this other thing. It's a land grab. What's that? And this is a situation where sanctions actually seem to do some good, because initially the government of El Salvador refused to leave. Only when threatened with sanctions from the OAS did they decide to do something and actually withdraw.
Mm-hmm. And when that ceasefire went into effect, thousands of people were already dead, at least 3,000, most of whom were Honduran nationals and civilians. They weren't, you know, they weren't soldiers, these folks. Mm-hmm. And many, many thousands more were displaced. They had to evacuate where they were living due to the fighting or the encroachment of the Salvadoran army. Eventually, like you said, international pressure, the threat of sanctions, these factors cause El Salvador to withdraw its forces from Honduras by August. And if we look at the aftermath, we see that thousands of people were killed on both sides. The Salvadoran military did pretty well, but the conflict was a lose-lose situation for both countries. As a result of the fighting, around 130,000 Salvadoran immigrants are trying to get back home to El Salvador, and they arrive in an already overpopulated country. Like you said, Noel, and like you said, Max, it's a kind of a fight for land. And because they added so many more people to the population, this destabilized the economy. Like, things go horribly wrong. That's the takeaway. Things went horribly wrong. And a lot of people remained convinced this was about a soccer game for a long time.
Yeah, that BBC piece that you mentioned has some really illuminating quotes from Dr. Mo Hume. Excellent name.
That's a cool
name.
He's
a lecturer at the University of Glasgow. And she referred to the domestic problems back in El Salvador that caused the war in the first place. Again, citing that small land-owning gentry and the large number of farmers who had been dispossessed of their land, and said that this is something that would have repercussions, you know, well into the future for maybe decades. The larger socioeconomic issues are really the whole deal here. And the football aspect was just kind of like the powder keg moment. But to your point, and to the point of many other experts, it didn't even need that particular powder keg. It just made for an interesting frame story, you know, for the press.
Exactly. And Professor Hume also makes an excellent point when she says this powder keg of tension and inequality that led to the football war would ultimately cause the civil war in El Salvador just a decade later, 1979, all the way up to 1992. And during that war, an estimated 70,000 people lost their lives. So this is a very serious thing.
It's so interesting. I mean, you think of the idea of a civil war, and in the United States, it obviously seems like something of the distant past. But no, civil wars continue across the world to this day. And to this day, there's still simmering resentment between El Salvador and Honduras. And there are continuously border disputes between the two nations.
Yes. And you know, I love the point you're making about civil wars. A lot of people aren't aware that the Guatemalan Civil War went from 1960 to 1996. So it was still very recent when I lived there. This gives us an instructive look at how war is sold to people, right? And about how easy it can be to obfuscate the actual causes of a conflict. There is a guy we want to shout out. He is the man who scored the winning goal for El Salvador. His name, Mauricio Rodriguez, Pipo to his friends. And Max with the facts came through and verified that Mr. Rodriguez is alive. He is now 76. And he pretty much seems to agree with the three of us when he says, "What I am sure of is that the authorities and politicians made use of our sports victory to glorify El Salvador's image." I like the phrase "sports victory." I don't know why.
I do.
It sounds like a translation from something in an IKEA store.
It does a little bit, but I think it hits the mark. And like you said, I mean, Mauricio Pipo Rodriguez really sums the whole thing up beautifully, saying that for me, that goal will always be a source of sporting pride. Despite the spin the government put on it. Spin? Is that a thing you do in soccer? Can you put some spin on the ball? I imagine you can.
You got to bend it like Beckham.
Bend it like Beckham.
How do you think he bends it?
Putting English on it? What, have you heard that phrase? That's from billiards, right?
It's from billiards. It's when you hit it on the top or the bottom, I believe, and it gives it, you can do a backspin. There's different types of English, but
I'm going to make my own
golf
sport.
Also.
Yeah, I think you definitely can.
I'm going to make my own sport. I think that's, the time has come.
We need a new sport, Ben. We don't have enough of them.
Do you want help, Ben? Like, so it actually, like, you know, works well and stuff?
Yeah, you know what? Why
Shots
not?
Shots fired, Max. Shots fired.
No, Max taught me how to play some dice games, so I'll follow.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just Max is an expert on game theory, which is a really important aspect of designing any sort of game, whether it be nerd-related or sport-related. And, you know, despite all of this fallout, and all of this association, football war and all of that stuff, soccer war, Rodriguez said that the El Salvador team had immense respect for their Honduran counterparts. He had this to say on the matter, and this is a quote from that BBC piece that we've referenced. "Neither from the Honduras players nor from our side were the games between enemies, but between sports rivals."
You know, that's awesome. And I think that is a good place for us to land the episode today, because you'll hear that from a lot of athletes. They'll say, you know, actually, I really like these other people, you know, who are competing with against me in the luge or what have you, because they're kind of like college.
It's called the pitch, Ben, not the luge.
No, I'm talking about the sport of luge.
I'm just joking.
Oh, you're kidding. Yeah, Max.
What is it called in luge?
Is it called the tube?
Yeah. The slide, the ice slide.
I think it actually is slide.
Oh, cool.
That makes sense because you slide. Okay.
Well, it's like an ice encrusted water slide.
Yeah. which, you know, every kid's dream, right? But here we end the story, and this is one of those tales that is illuminating, right? And it's important to remember this in the modern day, because we do see a lot of reporting that appears to determine the causes for a conflict, right? And you always have to ask yourself, what's going on? You know, even today, if you look at the situation between NATO, Ukraine, and Russia, you'll see that Russian domestic media has a very different spin on things compared to media in Ukraine or media in Europe. So we all have to work together to figure out what the truth is. And maybe it's just because we're getting around lunchtime now, but I am so excited to go see an Atlanta United game with you guys. The Mercedes-Benz Stadium is pretty swell. The first time I went there was abandoned. I went there to get vaccinated, but that place is huge.
Do you think Kanye West is still living in the janitor's quarters?
I hope so. I hope he is.
He's like the Phantom of the Opera.
I thought he wasn't Kanye anymore. I thought he was just Ye.
He's always going to be Kanye to me. I refuse to fall in line with that. It's absurd.
Maybe it's a thing where it's like, if you're, this is kind of a Southern thing, but maybe it's the thing where it's your full name if you're in trouble. So he's like, yay, unless he tries to start a war over soccer. And then we have to be like, Kanye?
More like boo, am I right?
Right. And so with that, thank you, of course, for tuning in. One note about the region of Central America, the countries of El Salvador and Honduras and all adjacent countries. They are beautiful, beautiful places. Visit if you get a chance. Be safe. And tell us of your adventures. We can't wait to hear from you. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Mr. Max Williams, and now our go-to sports correspondent. And thanks, of course, to Alex Williams, who composed this slapping soundtrack. Eat your heart out, yay.
Thanks to Christopher Hasiotis. He's Jeff Coat here in spirit. Jonathan Strickland, the Quizster. Surely he'll be darkening our digital doorstep in the near future. And thanks to you, Ben, for getting sporty with us today.
Thanks to you, Noel. And I just, I want to say, you know, if we were the Spice Girls, I don't know where we go with this. It's pretty clear Max would be Sporty Spice, right?
I feel like Sporty Spice is the most underrated Spice Girl. She needs to get more love. Let's do that. Let's honor her memory. I think she's still alive, but, you know, maybe not in Spice Girl form. Through super producer Max Williams. We love you, buddy. See you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.